bed, its minute chessmen sprinkled liberally around the room. But he has no memory of the throw itself or of shattering glass. He might have been drinking a toast to something or someone, with a radiator standing in for a fireplace. He doesn't remember. But nothing about the squalid scenery of room 505 can be said to surprise him, least of all the loaded Sholem in his hand. He checks the firing pin safety and returns the gun to its holster, slung across the back of the wing chair. Then he goes over to the wall and drags the pull-down bed from its notch. He peels back the covers and climbs in. The linens are clean, and they smell of the steam press and of the dust in the hole in the wall. Dimly, Lanzmann recalls conceiving a romantic project, sometime around midnight the night before, to show up for work early, see what forensics and ballistics have made of the Spillman case, maybe even go out to the islands, the Russian neighborhoods, and try to nudge the Potsar ex-con Vasily Shidnovitzer. Do what he can, give it his best shot, before Bina takes a pair of pliers to his teeth and claws at nine. He smiles ruefully at the headstrong young bravo he was last midnight. A 6 a.m. wake-up call. He pulls the covers up over his head and closes his eyes. Unbidden, the configuration of pawns and pieces lays itself out on a chessboard in his mind. The black king hemmed in, but unchecked at the center of the board, the white pawn on the B-file about to become something better. There is no longer any need for the pocket set. To his horror, he has the thing by heart. He tries to drive it from his mind, to expunge it, to sweep aside the pieces and fill in all the white checkers with black. An all-black board, uncorrupted by pieces or players, gambits or endgames, tempo or tactics or material advantage, black as the Baranoff Mountains. He is still lying there, all the white squares of his mind blotted out, in his underpants and socks, when there's a knock at the door. He sits up facing the wall, his heart a drum banging in his temples, the sheets pulled down tight over him like he's a kid hoping to spook somebody. He's been lying on his stomach, maybe for a while. He remembers hearing from the bottom of a tomb of black mud, in a lightless cave a mile beneath the surface of the earth, the distant vibrations of his chauffeur, and sometime after that, the soft chirping of the phone on the oak veneer table. But he was buried so deep under the mud that even if the telephones had been mere telephones in a dream, he would not have had the strength or the inclination to answer them. His pillow was drenched in a foul brew of drunk sweat, panic, and saliva. He looks at his watch. It's 10:20. Meyer! Lanzmann falls back onto the bed, upside down and tangled in the sheets. I quit, he says. Bina, I resign. Bina doesn't say anything right away. Lanzmann hopes she has accepted his resignation, which is superfluous anyway, and returned to the modular and the man from the burial society, and her transition from Jewish policewoman to an officer of the law of the great state of Alaska. Once he is sure she is gone, Lanzmann will arrange for the maid who changes the bedding and towels once a week to come in and shoot him. Then all she has to do to bury him is return the pull-down bed to its notch in the wall. His claustrophobia, his fear of the dark, will no longer trouble him. A moment later, he hears the teeth of a key in the lock, and the door of room 505 swings open. Bina creeps in the way you creep into a sick room, a cardiac ward, expecting a shock, reminders of mortality, grim truths about the body. "Jesus fucking Christ," she says with that flawless hardpan accent of hers. It is an expression that always strikes Lanzmann as curious, or at least as something that he would pay money to see. She wades through pieces of Lanzmann's gray suit and a bath towel and stands at the foot of the bed. Her eyes take in the pink wallpaper patterned with garlands and burgundy flock, the green plush carpet with its random motif of burn spots and mystery stains, the broken glass, the empty bottle, the peeling and chipped veneer of the pressboard furniture. Watching her with his head at the foot of the pull-down bed, Lanzmann enjoys the look of horror on her face, mostly because if he doesn't, then he will have to feel ashamed. "How do you say shit heap in Esperanto?" Bina says. She goes over to the veneer table and looks down at the last bedraggled curls of noodle pudding lying in the grease-streaked clamshell. "At least you ate something." She turns the wing chair around to face the bed, then lowers her tote to the ground. She studies the seat of the chair. From her face, he can see that she's wondering if she ought to go after the seat of the chair with something caustic or antibacterial out of her magic bag. At last she lowers herself into the wing chair, a little at a time. She's dressed in a gray pantsuit, some kind of slick stuff with an iridescent undersheen of black. Under the jacket she wears a silk shell in celadon green. Her face is bare except for two streaks of brick lip rouge on her mouth. At this hour of the day, her morning effort to control her tangled hair with pins and clips has not yet begun to fail. If she slept well last night, in the narrow bed in her old room, on the top floor of a two-family house on Japonsky Island, with old Mr. Oysher and his prosthetic leg bumping around downstairs, it doesn't show in the hollows and shadows of her face. Her eyebrows are all involved with each other again. Her rouged lips have narrowed to a brick-red seam 2 millimeters wide. "So how's your morning going, Inspector?"
"I don't like waiting," she says. "And I especially don't like waiting for you."
"Maybe you didn't hear me," Lonsman says. "I quit."
"It's funny, but you repeating that particular bit of idiocy does surprisingly little to improve my mood."
"I can't work for you, Bina. Come on. That's just insane. It's exactly the kind of insanity I would expect from the department right now. If things are that bad, if that's what it comes to, then forget it. I'm sick of all this play-out-the-string jazz. So no, I quit. What do you need me for? Slap black flags on all our cases. Open, closed, who gives a damn? It's just a bunch of dead yids anyway."
"I went through the stack again," she says.
He notes that after all these years, she has retained her thrilling power to ignore him in his bouts of blackness. "I didn't see anything in any of them that looked like it was going to tie in with the Verbivers." She reaches into her briefcase and takes out a pack of Broadways, shakes one loose, and fits it to her lips. She says the next 8 words in an offhand way that he immediately suspects. "Except for maybe that junkie you found downstairs."
"You black flagged that one," Lonsman replies with a policeman's perfect disingenuousness.
"You're smoking again, too?"
"Tobacco?
Mercury." She brushes back a coil of hair and lights her papyrus, blows smoke. "Playing out the string. Let me have one." She passes him the Broadway, and he sits up, winding himself in a careful toga of bed linens. She looks him over in his splendor as she lights a second papyrus. She notes the gray hair around his nipples, the progress of flab at his waist, his bony knees. "Sleeping in socks and underwear," she says. "Always a bad sign with you."
"I guess I have the cafard," he says. "I guess it kind of hit me last night."
"Last night?
Last year?"
She looks around for something to use as an ashtray. "Did you and Berko go out to Verbov Island yesterday," she says, "to poke around this Lasker thing?"
There's really no point in lying to her. But Lonsman has been disobeying orders far too long to start telling the truth about it now.
"You didn't get a call," he says.
"A call? From Verbov Island? On a Saturday morning? Who there's going to call me on a Saturday morning?"
Her eyes get shrewd, tight at the corners.
"And what are they going to tell me when they do?"
"I'm sorry," Lonsman says. "Excuse me, I can't hold it anymore." He gets up, stands right up in his underwear with a sheet hanging off him. He pads around the pull-down bed to the tiny bathroom with its sink and its steel mirror and its showerhead. There's no curtain, just a drain in the middle of the floor. He closes the door and urinates for a long time with genuine pleasure. Setting the burning papyrus on the edge of the toilet tank, he gives his face some brisk business with soap and a washcloth. There's a wool bathrobe, white with red, green, yellow, and black stripes, in an Indian pattern, on a hook behind the bathroom door. He ties it around himself. He puts the papyrus back into his mouth and looks at himself in the scratched rectangle of polished steel that's mounted above the sink. What he sees there affords him no surprises or unknown depths. He flushes the toilet and goes back into the room. "Bina," he says, "I did not know this man. He was put in my way. I was given the opportunity to know him, I suppose, but I declined it. If this man and I had gotten to know each other, possibly we could have become pals. Maybe not. He had his thing with heroin, and that was probably enough for him. It usually is. But whether I knew him or not, or whether we could have grown old together holding hands on a sofa down in the lobby, is neither here nor there. Somebody came into this hotel, my hotel, and shot that man in the back of the head while he was off in dreamland. And that bothers me. Set aside whatever general objections I might have worked up over the years to the underlying concept of homicide. Forget about right and wrong, law and order, police procedure, departmental policy, reversion, Jews and Indians. This dump is my house. For the next 2 months, or however long it turns out to be, I live here. All these hard lucks paying rent on a pull-down bed and a sheet of steel bolted to the bathroom wall, for better or worse,
They're my people now. I can't honestly say I like them very much. Some of them are all right. Most of them are pretty bad. But I'll be damned if I'm going to let somebody walk in here and put a bullet in their heads. Bina has boiled up 2 cups of instant coffee. She hands one to Lantzman. Black and sweet, she says. Right? Bina, you're on your own. The black flag stays put. You get caught. You get in a jam. You get your knees broken by Rudashevsky's. I don't know anything about it. She goes over to her bag and takes out an accordion file thick with folders. She puts it on the veneer table. The forensic is only a partial. Springer sort of left it hanging. Blood and hair. Latents. It isn't much. The ballistics are still out. Bina, thank you. Bina, listen, this guy. His name wasn't Lasker. This guy. She puts a hand to his mouth. She has not touched him in 3 years. It probably would be too much to say that he feels the darkness lift at the touch of her fingertips against his lips. But it shivers, and light bleeds in among the cracks. I don't know anything about it, she says. She removes her hand. She takes a sip of instant coffee and makes a face. Feh. She puts down the cup, picks up her bag, and goes to the door. She stops and looks back at Lantzman, standing there in the bathrobe that she bought for him on his birthday when he turned 35. You have some nerve, she says. I can't believe you when Berka went out there. We had to tell him his son was dead. His son? Mendel Spielman, the Rebbe's only son. Bina opens her mouth, then closes it. Not astonished so much as engaged, sinking her terrier teeth into the information, gnawing on the bloody joint of it. Lantzman can see that she likes the way it gives against the sharp grip of her jaw, but her eyes take on a weariness that Lantzman recognizes. Bina will never lose her detective's appetite for people's stories, Lantzman thinks, of puzzling her way back through them from the final burst of violence to the first mistake. But sometimes a shamus gets a little tired of that hunger. And what did the Rebbe say? She lets go of the doorknob with an air of genuine regret. He seemed a little bitter. Did he seem surprised? Not especially, but I don't know what you can make of that. I take it the kid had been heading down the chute for a long time. Do I think Spielman would have fed his own son a bullet? In theory, sure. That goes double for Barenstein. Her bag hits the floor like a body. She stands and works her shoulder in a small, aching circle. He could offer to massage it for her, but wisely he refrains. I suppose I can expect a phone call, she says, from Barenstein, as soon as there are 3 stars in the sky. Well, I wouldn't listen too carefully when he tries to tell you how broken up he is that Mendel Spielman is out of the picture. Everybody loves it when the prodigal returns, except for the guy that's been sleeping in his pajamas. Lantzman takes a sip of the coffee, dreadfully bitter and sweet. The prodigal. He was some kind of a miracle kid, at chess, at Torah, at languages. I heard a story today about him healing a woman's cancer, not that I really believe that, but I guess there were a lot of stories going around about him inside the black hat world, that he might be the Tzadik Hador, you know what that is? Sort of, yes. Anyway, I know what the words mean, Bina says. Her father, Gurya Gelbfish, is a learned man in the traditional sense, and he squandered a certain portion of his learning on his only child, a girl. The righteous man of this generation. So the story is that these guys, these tzaddiks, they have been showing up for work one per generation for the past couple of thousand years, right? Cooling their heels, waiting for the time to be right. Or the world to be right, or some people say for the time to be wrong and the world to be as wrong as it can be. Some of them we know about. Most of them kept a pretty low profile. I guess the idea is that the Tzadik Hador could be anyone. He is despised and rejected of men, Bina says, or rather recites. A man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. That's what I'm saying, says Lantzman. Anyone. A bum, a scholar, a junkie, even a shamus. I guess it could be, Bina says. She works it out in her mind, the road from wonder-working prodigy of the Verbivers to murdered junkie in a flophouse on Max Nordau Street. The story adds up in a way that appears to sadden her. Anyway, I'm glad it isn't me. You don't want to redeem the world anymore? Did I used to want to redeem the world? I think that you did, yes. She considers it, rubbing the side of her nose with a finger trying to remember. I guess I got over it, she says. But Lantzman doesn't buy that. Bina never stopped wanting to redeem the world. She just let the world she was trying to redeem get smaller and smaller until at one point it could be bounded in the hat of a hopeless policeman. It's all talking chickens to me now. She should probably exit on that line, but she stands around for another 15 seconds of unredeemed time, leaning against the door, watching Lanzmann fiddle with the frayed ends of his bathrobe sash. "What are you going to tell Berenstain when he calls?" Lanzmann says. "That you were totally out of line, and I'll see that you come up for a board. I may have to lift your shield. I'll try to fight it, but with a Schomer from the Burial Society coming— Spade, a curse on him— I don't have a lot of room to maneuver, and neither do you." "Okay, you warned me," Lanzmann says. "I have been warned." "So what are you going to do?" "Now? Now I want to put a touch on the mother. Spielman said nobody ever heard from Mendel or spoke to him, but for some reason I'm not inclined to take his word for it." "Bathsheba Spielman. That is going to be a tough touch," Bina says, "especially for a man." "True," Lanzmann says with a display of wistfulness. "No," Bina says. "No, Maya, forget it. You are on your own. She'll be at the funeral. All you need to do is—" "All I need to do," Bina says, "is stay out of the way of Schomer's, watch my ass, and get through the next 2 months without setting fire to it." "I'd be happy to watch her ass for you," Lanzmann says, just for old time's sake. "Get dressed," Bina says, "and do yourself a favor. Clean this shit up. Look at this dump. I can't believe you're living like this. Sweet God, aren't you ashamed of yourself?" Once, Bina Gelbfish believed in Meyer Lanzmann, or she believed, from the moment she met him, that there was a sense in that meeting, that some detectable intention lay behind their marriage. They were twisted like a pair of chromosomes, of course they were, but where Lanzmann saw in that twisting together only a tangle, a chance snarling of lines, Bina saw the hand of the maker of knots. And for her faith, Lanzmann repaid her with his faith in nothing itself. "Only every time I see your face," Lanzmann says. 20. Lanzmann cadges half a dozen papyruses from the weekend manager Cronkite, then kills an hour setting fire to three of them while the reports on the dead man in 208 render up their pitiful account of proteins and grease marks and dust. As Bean has said, there's nothing new in any of it. The killer seems to have been a professional, a schlosser of skill who left no trace of his passage. The dead man's fingerprints match those on record for a Menachem Mendel Spielman, arrested 7 times on drug charges over the past 10 years under a variety of aliases, including Wilhelm Steinitz, Aaron Nimzowitsch, and Richard Rady. So much and no more is clear. Lanzmann contemplates sending down for a pint, but he takes a hot shower instead. Alcohol has failed him. The thought of food turns his stomach, and let's face it, if he was ever really going to kill himself, he would have done so long before now. So all right, work is a joke. It remains work. And that is the true content of the accordion file that Bina brought him, her message to him across the divide of departmental policy and marital estrangement and careers rolling in opposite directions. Just keep at it. Lanzmann frees his last clean suit from its plastic sack, shaves his chin, works up a lustrous nap in his pork pie hat with his hat brush. He is off duty today, but duty means nothing. Today means nothing. Nothing means anything but a clean suit, 3 fresh Broadways, the wobble of the hangover just behind his eyes, the murmur of the brush against the whiskey-brown felt of his hat, and, all right, maybe a trace in his hotel room of the smell of Bina, of the sour collar of her shirt, her verbena soap, the marjoram smell of her armpit. He rides down in the elevator, feeling as if he has stepped out from under the onrushing shadow of a plummeting piano, some kind of jazzy clangor in his ear. The knot of his golden-green rep necktie presses its thumb against his larynx like a scruple pressing against a guilty conscience, a reminder that he is alive. His hat is as glossy as a seal. Max Nordau Street has not been plowed. The road crews of Sitka, slashed to skeletons, concentrate on the arterials and the highway. Lanzmann leaves the supersport with the garage man after retrieving his rubber overshoes from the trunk. Then he stomps his way carefully through the foot-deep drifts to Mobway Donuts and Monastir Street. The Filipino-style Chinese donut, or shtekala, is the great contribution of the district of Sitka to the food lovers of the world. In its present form, it cannot be found in the Philippines. No Chinese trencherman would recognize it as the fruit of his native fry kettles. Like the storm god Yahweh of Sumeria, the shtekala was not invented by the Jews,
but the world would sport neither God nor the shtekla without Jews and their desires. A panatella of fried dough, not quite sweet, not quite salty, rolled in sugar, crisp-skinned, tender inside, and honeycombed with air pockets. You sink it in your paper cup of milky tea and close your eyes, and for 10 fat seconds, you seem to glimpse the possibility of finer things. The hidden master of the Filipino-style Chinese donut is Benito Taganas, proprietor and king of the bubbling vats at Mabue. Mabue, dark, cramped, invisible from the street, stays open all night long. It drains the bars and cafes after hours, concentrates the wicked and the guilty along its chipped formica counter, and thrums with the gossip of criminals, policemen, starkers and schlemiels, whores and night owls. With the fat applauding in the fryers, the exhaust fans roaring, and the boombox blasting the heart-sick kundamins of Benito's Manila childhood, the clientele makes free with their secrets. A golden mist of kosher oil hangs in the air and baffles the senses. Who could overhear with ears full of kosher fry and the wailing of Diomedes Maturin? But Benito Taganas overhears, and he remembers. Benito could draw you a family tree for Alexei Lebed, the chieftain of the Russian mob. Only on it you would find not grandparents and nieces, but bagmen, bump-offs, and offshore bank accounts. He could sing you a kundamin of wives who remain loyal to their imprisoned husbands, and husbands doing time because their wives drop dimes on them. He knows who's keeping the head of Furry Markov in his garage, and which narcotics inspector is on the payroll of Anatoly Moskowitz, the wild beast. Only nobody knows that he knows but Meyer Lantzman. A donut, Reb Taganas, Lantzman says when he comes stomping in from the alley, shivering the crust of snow from his overshoes. The Sitka Saturday afternoon lies dead as a failed messiah in its winding rag of snow. There was nobody on the sidewalk, hardly a car in the street. But here inside Mabue Donuts, 3 or 4 floaters, solitaries, and drunks between benders lean against the sparkly resin counter, sucking the tea from their shtekelas and working the calculations of their next big mistakes. Only one, Benito says. He is a squat, thick man with skin the color of the milky tea he serves, his cheeks pitted like a pair of dark moons. Though his hair is black, he's past 70. As a young man, he was the flyweight champion of Luzon, and with his thick fingers and the tattooed salamis of his forearms, he gets taken for a tough customer, which serves the needs of his business. His big caramel eyes betray him, so he keeps them hooded and downcast. But Lantzman has looked into them. To run a stinker, you have to see the broken heart inside the deadest pan. Look like you should eat a couple, maybe 3, detective. Benito elbows aside the nephew or cousin he's got working the fry basket, and snake charms a rope of raw dough into the fat. A few minutes later, Lantzman is holding a tight paper packet of heaven in his hand. I have that information you wanted on Olivia's sister's daughter, Lantzman says, around a warm, sugary mouthful. Benito draws a cup of tea for Lantzman and then nods toward the alley. He pulls on his anorak and they go out. Benito takes a ring of keys from his belt loop and works open an iron door 2 doors down from Mabue Donuts. This is where Benito keeps his lover, Olivia, in 3 small, tidy rooms with a Warhol portrait of Dietrich and a bitter smell of vitamins and rotten gardenia. Olivia's not there. The lady has been in and out of the hospital lately, dying in chapters with a cliffhanger at the end of every one. Benito waves Lantzman into a red leather armchair piped in white. Of course, Lantzman has no information for Benito about any of Olivia's sister's daughters. Olivia is not really a lady either, but Lantzman is also the only one who knows that about Benito Taganas, the Donut King. Years ago, a serial rapist named Cohn forced himself on Miss Olivia Logdemeo and found out her secret. Cohn's second big surprise that night was the chance appearance of patrolman Lantzman. What Lantzman did to Cohn's face left the momser talking with a slur for the rest of his life, so it's a mixture of gratitude and shame, and not money, that drives the flow of information from Benito to the man who saved Olivia. Ever hear anything about the son of Heschkel Spielman? Lantzman says, setting down the donuts and the cup of tea. Kid named Mendel? Benito stands, hands clasped behind his back, like a boy called on to recite a poem at school. Over the years, he says, a thing or two. A junkie, no? Lantzman arcs one fuzzy eyebrow a quarter of an inch. You don't answer a stinker's questions, especially not the rhetorical ones. Mendel Spielman, Benito decides. Seen him around maybe a few times. Funny guy. Talk a little Tagalog. Sing a little Filipino song. What happened? He not dead?
Still, Lanzmann doesn't say anything, but he likes Benny Taganis, and running him always feels a little rude. To cover the silence, he picks up the shtekel and takes a bite. It's still warm, and there's a hint of vanilla, and the crust crunches between his teeth like a caramel glaze on a pot of custard. As it goes into Lanzmann's mouth, Benito watches with the appraising coldness of an orchestra conductor auditioning a flautist.
That's good, Benny.
Don't insult me, detective, I beg you.
Sorry.
I know it's good.
The best.
Nothing in your life even comes close.
This is so easily true that the sentiment brings a sting of tears to Lanzmann's eyes, and to cover that, he eats another donut.
Somebody was looking for the Yid, Benito says in his rough and fluent Yiddish. 2-3 months back, a couple somebodies.
You saw them?
Benito shrugs. His tactics and operations, he keeps a mystery from Lanzmann, the cousins and nephews, and the network of substinkers he employs.
Somebody saw them, he says. It might have been me.
Were they black hats?
Benito considers the question for a long moment, and Lanzmann can see it troubles him in a way that's somehow scientific, almost pleasurable. He gives his head a slow, certain shake.
No black hats, he says. But beards.
Beards? You mean, what, they were religious types?
Little yarmulkes. Neat beards, young men.
Russians? Accents?
If I heard about these young men, then the one who told me didn't say nothing about accents. If I saw them myself, then I'm sorry, I don't remember.
Hey, what's the matter? What for? You don't write this down, detective?
Early on in their collaboration, Lanzmann made a show of taking Benito's information very seriously. Now he fishes out his notebook and scratches a line or two, just to keep the Donut King happy. He's not sure what to make of them, these 2 or 3 neat young Jews, religious but not black hat.
And they were asking what exactly, please, he says.
Whereabouts. Information.
Did they get it?
Not at my boy Donuts. Not from a Taganis.
Benito's chauffeur rings, and he snaps it open and lays it against his ear. All the hardness goes out of the lines around his mouth. His face matches his eyes now, soft, brimming with feeling. He rattles on tenderly in Tagalog. Lanzmann catches the lowing sound of his own last name.
How's Olivia? Lanzmann asks as Benito closes his phone and ladles a yard of cold plaster into the mold of his face.
She can't eat, Benito says. No more shtekelis.
That's a shame.
They're through. Lanzmann gets up, slips the notebook back into his hip pocket, and feeds himself the last bite. He feels stronger and happier than he has in weeks or perhaps months. There is something in the death of Mendel Spillman, a story to grab hold of, and it's shaking the dust and spiders off him. Or else it's the donut. They head for the door, but Benito puts a hand on Lanzmann's arm.
Why you don't ask me anything else, detective?
What would you like me to ask you? Lanzmann frowns, then lights doubtfully on a question.
You heard something today, maybe?
Something out at Verbov Island?
It's hard to imagine, but not inconceivable, that word of Verbover displeasure over Lanzmann's visit to the Rebbe already would have reached Benito's ears.
Verbov Island?
No, another thing.
You still looking for Zilberblatt?
Victor Zilberblatt is one of the 11 outstanding cases that Lanzmann and Berko are supposed to be resolving effectively. Zilberblatt was stabbed to death last March outside of the Hofbrau Tavern in the Nachtassel, the old German quarter, a few blocks from here. The knife was small and dull, and the murder had an unstudied air.
Somebody see the brother, Benito Taganis says.
Rafi,
sneaking around.
Nobody was sorry to see Victor go, least of all his brother Raphael. Victor had abused Raphael, cheated him, humiliated him, and made free with his cash and his woman. After Victor died, Raphael left town, whereabouts unknown. The evidence linking Raphael to the knife is inconclusive at best. 2 semi-reliable witnesses put him 40 miles away from the Nachtassel for 2 hours on either side of the likely time of his brother's murder. But Rafi Zilberblatt has a long and monotonous police record, and he will do very nicely, Lanzmann reflects, given the lowered standard of proof that the new policy implies.
Sneaking where? Lanzmann says. The information is like a hot black mouthful of coffee. He can feel himself coiling around Raphael Zilberblatt's freedom like a 100-pound snake.
That big maca store, it's gone now, up at Granite Creek. Somebody see him sneaking in and out of there, carrying things. A can of propane. Maybe he living inside the empty store.
Thanks, Benny, Lanzmann says. I'll check it out.
Lanzmann starts to let himself out of the apartment. Benito Taganis takes hold of his sleeve. He smooths the collar of Lantzman's overcoat with a paternal hand. He brushes away the crumbs of cinnamon sugar. "Your wife," he says. "Here again?" "In all her glory." "Nice lady. Benny says hello." "I'll tell her to drop by." "Now you don't tell her nothing," Benito grins. "Now she your boss."
"She was always my boss," Lantzman says. "Now it's just official."
The grin winks out, and Lantzman averts his gaze from the spectacle of Benito Taganis's grieving eyes. Benito's wife is a voiceless and shadowy little woman, but Miss Olivia in her heyday conducted herself like the boss of half the world.
"Better for you," Benito says. "You need."
This ends Disc 4. The Yiddish Policeman's Union, Disc 5.
21. Lantzman straps an extra clip to his belt and drives out to the north end past Halibut Point, where the city sputters and the water reaches across the land like the arm of a policeman. Just off the Ickes Highway, the wreck of a shopping center marks the end of the dream of Jewish Sitka. The push to fill every space from here to Yakovy with the Jews of the world gave out in this parking lot. There was no permanent status, no influx of new Jew flesh from the bitter corners and dark alleys of diaspora. The planned housing developments remained lines on blue paper, encumbering some steel drawer. The Granite Creek Big Macher outlet died about 2 years ago. Its doors are chained, and along its windowless flank, where Yiddish and Roman characters once spelled out the name of the store, there is only a cryptic series of holes, domino pips, a braille of failure. Lantzman leaves his car at the median and hikes across the giant frozen blank of the parking lot toward the front door. The snow is not as deep here as in the streets of the central city. The sky is high and pale gray, with darker gray tiger stripes. Lantzman huffs through his nostrils as he marches toward the glass doors, their handles pinioned like arms with a dangling length of blue rubberized chain. Lantzman has this idea that he's going to knock on those doors with his shield held high and his attitude vibrating like a force field, and that slinking whippet of a man, Rafi Zilberblatt, is going to step sheepish and blinking into the snow-dazzling day. The first bullet blackens the air alongside Lantzman's right ear like a fat humming fly. He doesn't even know it's a bullet until he hears or remembers hearing a muffled burst and then a clamor of the glass. By then he's falling on his belly in the snow, flattening himself on the ground, where the next bullet finds the back of his head and burns it like a trail of gasoline touched by a match. Lantzman drags out his sholem, but there is a cobweb in his head or over his face, and the paralysis of regret affects him. His plan was no plan at all, and now it has gone bad. He has no backup. Nobody knows where he is but Benito Taganis, with his molasses gaze and his all-but-universal silence. Lantzman is going to die in a desolate parking lot at the margin of the world. He closes his eyes. He opens them, and the cobweb is denser and sparkling with some kind of dew. Footsteps in the snow, more than one person. Lantzman raises his gun and takes aim through the sparkling strands of whatever is going wrong in his brain. He fires. There is a cry of pain, feminine, a whiff of breath, and then the lady wishes a cancer upon Lantzman's testicles. Snow packs Lantzman's ears and melts into the collar of his coat and down his neck. Somebody snatches at Lantzman's gun and tries to drag him to his feet. Popcorn on the breath. The bandage over Lantzman's eyes stretches thin as he lurches upright. He can see the mustachioed snout of Rafi Zilberblatt, and by the doors of the Big Macher, a plump bottle blonde lying on her back, her life pumping from her belly into the steaming red snow. And a couple of guns, one of them in Zilberblatt's hand, pointed at Lantzman's head. At the glint of the automatic, the cobweb of Lantzman's regrets and self-recriminations goes away. The smell of popcorn coming from inside the abandoned store alters his perception of the smell of blood and brings out the sweetness of it. Lantzman ducks and lets go of his Smith & Wesson. Zilberblatt was yanking so hard on the gun that when Lantzman unclenches, the other man goes tumbling backward into the snow. Lantzman scrambles on top of Zilberblatt. He's just acting now, without a thought in his head. He yanks his sholem loose and turns it around, and the world pulls the trigger on all its guns. Zilberblatt grows a horn of blood from the crown of his head. The cobwebs are now in Lantzman's ears. He can hear only the breath at the back of his throat and his own blood pulsing. For an instant, a strange peace opens like an umbrella inside Lantzman as he straddles the man he just killed, knees burning in the snow.
He retains the presence of mind to recognize that this tranquility is not necessarily a good sign. Then the doubts begin to crowd in around the knowledge of the mess he has made. Bystanders gathering around a suicide leaper. Lanzmann staggers to his feet. He sees the gore on his coat, the tatters of brain, a tooth. Two dead humans in the snow. The smell of popcorn, a buttery stink of feet, overwhelms him. While he is busy heaving up his guts into the snow, another man wanders out of the Big Macher store, a young man with a rat snout and a loping gait. Lanzmann retains the wit to mark him as a Zilberblatt. This Zilberblatt has his arms raised and a wild look on his face. His hands are empty. But when he sees Lanzmann bleeding and sick on all fours, he abandons his project of surrender. He picks up the automatic lying on the ground by the ruin of his brother. Lanzmann careens to his feet, and the trail of fire at the back of his head flares up. He feels the ground give way, and then there is a roaring blackness. After he dies, he wakes up lying face down in the snow. He can't feel snow on his cheek. The wild ringing in his ears is gone. He humps himself up to a sitting position. The blood from the back of his head has scattered rhododendrons in the snow. The man and the woman he shot have not moved, but there is no sign of the young Zilberblatt who did or did not shoot and kill him. With a sudden clarity of thought and a mounting suspicion that he has forgotten to die, Lanzmann pats himself down. His watch, wallet, car keys, cell phone, gun, and badge are gone. He looks for his car parked in the distance along the frontage road. When he sees that his supersport is gone, he knows that he is still alive, because only life could offer such a bitter vista. "Another fucking Zilberblatt," he says. "And they're all like that." He is cold. He considers entering the Big Macher, but the stench of popcorn keeps him away. He turns from the yawning doors and lifts his eyes toward the high hill and beyond it to the mountains, black with trees. Then he sits down in the snow. After a while, he lies down. It's snug and comfortable, and there's a smell of cool dust, and he closes his eyes and falls asleep, folded up into his nice, dark little hole in the wall of the Hotel Zamenhof. And for once in his life, the claustrophobia doesn't trouble him. Not a bit. 22. Lanzmann is holding a baby boy. The baby cries for no very grave reason. His wailing constricts Lanzmann's heart in a pleasurable way. Lanzmann feels relieved to discover that he has a fat, handsome baby who smells of waffles and soap. He squeezes the puffy feet, gauges the weight of the little grandfather in his arms, at once negligible and vast. He turns to Bina to tell her the good news. It was all a mistake. Here is their boy. But there is no Bina to tell, only the memory in Lanzmann's nostrils of rain on her hair. And then he wakes up and realizes that the crying baby is Pinky Shemitz, having his diaper changed or registering a protest over something or other. Lanzmann blinks, and the world intrudes in the form of a batik wall covering, and he is hollowed out, as if it's the first time, by the loss of his son. Lanzmann is lying on Berko and Esther Malka's bed on his side, facing the wall with its dyed linen scenes of Balinese gardens and savage birds. Someone has undressed him, leaving him in his underpants. He sits up. The skin at the back of his head prickles, and then a cord of pain goes taut. Lanzmann pats the site of his injury. A bandage meets his fingers, a crinkly oblong of gauze and tape. Surrounding it, a queer, hairless patch of scalp. Memories fall on top of one another with a slapping sound like crime scene photographs fresh from Dr. Springer's death camera. A jocular emergency room tech, an X-ray, an injection of morphine, a looming swab dipped in betadine. Before that, the light from a street lamp striping the white vinyl ceiling of an ambulance. And before that, before the ride in the ambulance, purple slush, steam from the spilled contents of a human gut, a hornet at his ear, a red jet bursting from the forehead of Rafi Zilberblatt, a cipher of holes in a blank expanse of plaster. Lanzmann backs away from the memory of what happened in the Big Macher parking lot, so quickly that he bumps right into the pang of losing Django Lanzmann in his dream. "Woe is me," Lanzmann says. He wipes his eyes. He would give up a gland, a minor organ, for a papyrus. The bedroom door opens and Berko comes in, carrying an almost full pack of Broadways. "Have I ever told you that I love you?" Lanzmann says, knowing full well that he never has. "You never have, thank God," Berko says. I got these from the neighbor, the freed woman. I told her it was a police seizure. I am insanely grateful. I note the adverb. Berko notes also that Lantzman has been crying. One eyebrow shoots up, hangs suspended, drifts down like a tablecloth settling onto a table. Baby okay? Lantzman says. Teeth. Berko takes a coat hanger from a hook on the back of the bedroom door. On the hanger are Lantzman's clothes, neat and brushed. Berko feels around in the hip pocket of Lantzman's blazer and produces a matchbook. Then he comes and stands by the bed and holds out the papyruses and matches. I can't honestly claim, says Lantzman, that I know what I'm doing here. It was Esther Malka's idea, knowing how you feel about hospitals. They said you didn't need to stay. Have a seat. There is no chair in the room. Lantzman slides over and Berko sits down on the edge of the bed, causing alarm among the bedsprings. It's really okay if I smoke? Not really, no. Go stand by the window. Lantzman tips himself out of the bed. When he rolls up the bamboo shade on the window, he is surprised to see that it's pouring rain. The smell of rain blows in through the 2 inches the window has been cranked open, explaining the fragrance of Bina's hair in his dream. Lantzman looks down to the parking lot of the apartment building and observes that the snow has melted and been washed away. The light feels all wrong, too. What time is it? 4:30. 2, Berko says without checking his watch. What day is it? Sunday. Lantzman cranks open the window all the way and hooks his left buttock over the sill. Rain falls on his aching head. He lights his papyrus and takes a long drag and tries to decide if he's disturbed by this information. Long time since I did that, he says. Slept through a whole day. You must have needed it, Berko observes blandly. A sideways look in Lantzman's direction. Esther Malka's the one who took your pants off, by the way, just so you know. Lantzman flicks ash out of the window. I was shot. Grazed. They said it's more like a kind of burn. They didn't need to stitch it. There were three of them. Raphael Zilberblatt, a pitcher I made for his brother, and some chicken. The brother took my car, my wallet, my badge, and my sholem. Left me there. So it was reconstructed. I wanted to call for help, but the little rat-faced Jew took my chauffeur, too. The mention of Lantzman's phone makes Berko smile. What? Lantzman says. So, your pish is tooling along. North on the Ickes, headed for Yakovy, Fairbanks, Irkutsk. Uh-huh. Your phone rings. Your pisher answers it. And it's you? Bina. I like it. 2 minutes on the phone with the Zilberblatt. She has his whereabouts, his description, the name of his dog when he was 11. A couple of latkes pick him up 5 minutes later outside Krestov. Your car is fine. Your wallet still had cash in it. Lantzman affects to take an interest in the way that fire turns cured tobacco to flakes of ash. And my badge and gun, he says? Ah. Ah. Your badge and your gun are now in the hands of your commanding officer. Does she intend to return them? Berko reaches over and smooths the indentation that Lantzman left in the surface of his bed. It was strictly line of duty, Lantzman says, his tone sounding whiny even to his own ear. I got a tip on Rafi Zilberblatt. He shrugs and runs his fingers along the bandage at the back of his head. I just wanted to talk to the Yid. You should have called me first. I didn't want to bother you on a Saturday. It's no excuse, and it comes out even lamer than Lantzman hoped. No, I'm an idiot, Lantzman admits, and a bad policeman, too. Rule number one. I know. I just felt like doing something right then. I didn't think it was going to go the way that it went. In any case, Berko says, the pisher, the little brother, calls himself Willie Zilberblatt. He confessed on his late brother's behalf. Says indeed Rafi killed Victor. With half a pair of scissors. How about that? All other things being equal, I would say Bina has reason to be happy with you on that one. You resolved it very effectively. Half a pair of scissors. How's that for resourceful? Frugal, even. And the chicken you handled so roughly. That was you, too? It was me. Nicely done, Meyer. There is no sarcasm in Berko's tone or face. You put a pill in Yakovid Fleiterman. I did not. You had yourself quite a day. The nurse? Our colleagues on the B-Squad are delighted with you. That killed that old geezer, what's-his-name, Herman Posner? It was their only open case from last year. They thought she was in Mexico. Fuck me, Lantzman says in American. Tabachnik and Karp has already put in a good word for you with Bina, as I understand.
Lanzmann grinds the papyrus out against the side of the building, then flicks the butt into the rain. Tabachnik and Karpus are really kicking the asses of Lanzmann and Shemitz. It's not even close.
Even when I have good luck, he says, it's bad luck.
He sighs. Has there been anything out of Verbov Island?
Not a peep.
Nothing in the papers?
Not in the Licht or the Rut.
These are the leading black hat dailies.
No rumors that I've heard. Nobody's talking about it. Nothing. Total silence.
Lanzmann gets up off the windowsill and goes to the phone on the table beside the bed. He dials a number he memorized years ago, asks a question, gets an answer, hangs up. The Verbovers picked up Mendel Spielman's body late last night. The telephone in Lanzmann's hand startles, chirping like a robot bird. He passes it to Berko.
He seems fine, Berko says after a moment.
Yes, I imagine that he will need some rest.
All right.
He lowers the handset and stares at it, covering the mouthpiece with the pad of his thumb.
Your ex-wife.
I hear you're fine, Bina tells Lanzmann when he gets on the phone.
So they tell me, Lanzmann says.
Take some time, she suggests. Give yourself a break. The import takes a second to register. Her tone is so gentle and unruffled.
You would not, he says. Bina, please tell me this is not true.
Two dead people by your gun. No witnesses but a kid who didn't see what happened. It's automatic. Suspension with pay, pending a review by the board.
They were shooting guns at me. I had a reliable tip. I approached with my gun in my holster. I was polite as a mouse, and they started shooting at me.
And of course you'll get the chance to tell your story. In the meantime, I'm going to keep your shield and your gun in this nice pink plastic Hello Kitty zipper bag that Willie Zilberblatt was carrying them around in, okay? And you just try to get yourself all nice and better, all right?
This thing could take weeks to sort out, Lanzmann says. By the time I'm back on duty, there might not be a Sitka Central.
There are no grounds for a suspension here, and you know it. Under the circumstances, you can keep me on active duty while the review goes forward, and still be running this case totally by the book.
There are books, Bina says, and there are books.
Don't be cryptic, he says, and then an American.
What the fuck?
For a long couple of seconds, Bina doesn't reply.
I had a call from Chief Inspector Weingartner. Last night.
Not long, she says, after dark.
I see.
He tells me he just had a call. On his home phone, this is. And I guess the esteemed gentleman on the other end of the line was maybe a little upset about certain behaviors that Detective Meyer Lanzmann might have been exhibiting in this gentleman's neighborhood on Friday afternoon. Creating public disturbances, showing grave disrespect for the locals, operating without authority or approval.
And Weingartner replied,
he said you were a good detective, but you were known to have certain problems. And there, Lanzmann, is the line for your headstone.
So what did you tell Weingartner, he says, when he called to ruin your Saturday night?
My Saturday night. My Saturday night is like a microwave burrito, very tough to ruin something that starts out so bad to begin with. As it happens, I told Chief Inspector Weingartner how you had just been shot.
And he said,
that in light of this fresh evidence, he might have to reconsider long-held atheistic beliefs, and that I should do whatever I could to make sure you were comfortable, and that for the next little time, you got plenty of rest. So that's what I'm doing. You're suspended, with full pay, until further notice.
Bina, Bina, please, you know how I am.
I do.
If I can't work, you can't.
I have to. The temperature of her voice drops so quickly that ice crystals tinkle on the line. You know how much of a choice I have in a situation like this.
You mean when gangsters pull strings to keep a murder investigation from going forward? That the kind of situation you mean?
I answer to the chief inspector, Bina explains, as if she's talking to a donkey. She knows perfectly well that there is nothing Lanzmann hates more than being treated like he's stupid.
And you answer to me.
I wish you hadn't called my phone, Lanzmann says after a moment. Better you should just have let me die.
Don't be melodramatic, Bina says.
Oh, and you're welcome.
And what am I supposed to do now besides be grateful for having my balls cut off?
That's up to you, detective. Maybe you could try thinking about the future for a change.
The future, Lantzman says. You mean what, like flying cars, hotels on the moon? I mean your future. You want to go to the moon with me, Bina? I hear they still take Jews. Goodbye, Meyer. She hangs up. Lantzman cuts the connection on his end and stands there for a minute with Berko watching him from the bed. Lantzman feels a last surge of anger and enthusiasm blow through him, like a clot of dust being cleared from a pipe. Then he's empty. He sits down on the bed. He gets in under the covers and turns his face back to the Bolognese scene on the wall and closes his eyes.
Meyer, Berko says, but Lantzman doesn't answer. You planning to stay in my bed a whole lot longer?
Lantzman sees no percentage in answering the question. After a minute, Berko bounces himself off the mattress and onto his feet. Lantzman can feel him studying the situation, appraising the depth of black water that separates the two partners, trying to make the right call.
For what it's worth, Berko says finally, Bina also came to see you in the ER.
Lantzman finds he has no memory of this visit at all. It's gone, like the squeeze of a baby's foot against his palm.
You were doped up pretty good, Berko says. Talking many kinds of shit.
Did I embarrass myself with her? Lantzman manages to ask in a tiny voice.
Yes, Berko says. I fear that you did.
Then he withdraws from his own bedroom and leaves Lantzman there to puzzle out the question, if he can muster the strength, of how much further he can sink. Lantzman can hear them talking about him in the hushed tones reserved for madmen, assholes, and unwanted guests, all through the rest of the afternoon as they eat their dinner. Through the uproar of bath and ass-powdering and a bedtime story that requires Berko Shemitz to honk like a goose, Lantzman lies on his side with a burning seam at the back of his skull and drifts in and out of consciousness of the smell of rain at the window, the murmuring and clamor of the family in the other room. Every hour that passes, another 100 weight of sand is poured in through a tiny hole in Lantzman's soul. First he can't lift his head off the mattress, then he can't seem to open his eyes. After his eyes are closed, what happens is never quite sleep, and the thoughts that plague him, though atrocious, are never quite dreams. Sometime in the middle of the night, Goldie careers into the room. His tread is heavy and lumbering, a baby monster's. He doesn't just climb into the bed. He roils the blankets the way a wire whisk roils a batter. It's like he's fleeing something, panicked, but when Lantzman speaks, asks him what's wrong, the boy doesn't answer. His eyes are closed, and his heart beats steadily and low. Whatever he was running from, he found shelter from it in his parents' bed. The kid is sound asleep. He smells like a piece of cut apple that's starting to turn. He digs his toes into the small of Lantzman's back with care and without mercy. He grinds his teeth. The sound of it is like dull shears on a sheet of tin. After an hour of this kind of treatment, around 4:30, the baby starts to scream, way out on his balcony. Lantzman can hear Esther Malka trying to comfort him. Ordinarily, she would bring him into her bed, but that's not an option tonight, and it takes her a long time to settle the little grandfather down. By the time Esther Malka wanders into the bedroom with the baby in her arms, he's snuffling and quieter and almost asleep. Esther Malka dumps Pinky between his brother and Lantzman and walks out. Reunited in their parents' bed, the Shemitz boys set up a whistling and rumbling and a blatting of inner valves that would shame the grand pipe organ of Temple Emmanuel. The boys execute a series of maneuvers, a kung fu of slumber, that drives Lantzman to the very limit of the bed. They chop at Lantzman, stab him with their toes, grunt and mutter. They masticate the fiber of their dreams. Around dawn, something very bad happens in the baby's diaper. It's the worst night that Lantzman has ever spent on a mattress, and that is saying a good deal. The coffee maker begins its expectorations around 7. A few thousand molecules of coffee vapor tumble into the bedroom and worry the hairs inside Lantzman's beak. He hears the shuffle of slippers against the carpet in the hall. He fights long and hard against the impulse to acknowledge that Esther Malka is standing there in the doorway of her bedroom, ruining him and every fit of charity toward him that's ever seized her. He doesn't care. Why should he care? At last, Lantzman realizes that in his struggle not to care about anything lie the paradoxical seeds of defeat. So, all right, he cares. He opens one eye. Esther Malka leans against the door jamb, hugging herself, surveying the scene of destruction in a place that once was her bed. Whatever the name of the emotion inspired in a mother by the sight of filial cuteness, It competes in her expression with horror and dismay at the spectacle of Lantzman in his underpants.
"I need you out of my bed," she whispers, "soon and in a way that's lasting."
"All right," says Lantzman. Taking stock of his wounds, his aches, the prevailing direction of his moods, he sits up. For all the torment of the night, he feels oddly settled, more present somehow in his limbs and skin and senses. Somehow, maybe, a little more real. He has not shared a bed with another human being in over 2 years. He wonders if that is a practice he ought not to have foregone. He takes his clothes from the door and puts them on. Carrying his socks and belt, he follows Esther Malka back down the hall. "Though the couch has its points," Esther Malka continues. "For example, it features no babies or four-year-olds." "You have a serious toenail problem among your youth," Lantzman says. "Also something, I think it might be a sea otter, died and is rotting in the little one's diaper." In the kitchen, she pours them each a cup of coffee. Then she goes to the door and retrieves the tog from the mat that says, "Get lost." Lantzman sits on his stool at the counter and stares into the murk of the living room where the bulk of his partner rears up from the floor like an island. The couch is a wreck of blankets. Lantzman is about to tell Esther Malka, "I don't deserve friends like you," when she comes back into the kitchen reading the paper and says, "No wonder you needed so much sleep." She bumps into the doorway. Something good or terrible or unbelievable is described on the front page. Lantzman reaches for his reading glasses in the pocket of his jacket. They are cracked at the nose piece, each lens severed from its mate. It's truly a pair of glasses, two monocles on their stems. Esther Malka gets the electrician's tape, yellow as a hazard warning, from the drawer under the phone. She binds up the glasses and passes them back to Lantzman. The gob of tape is as thick as a filbert. It draws the gaze even of the wearer, leaving him cross-eyed. "I bet that looks really good," he says, taking up the newspaper. Two big stories lead off the news in this morning's Tag. One is an account of an apparent shootout leaving two dead in the deserted parking lot of a Big Macher outlet store. The principals were a lone homicide detective, Meyer Lantzman, 42, and two suspects long sought by Sitka law enforcement in connection with a pair of apparently unrelated murders. The other story is headlined, "Boyd Sadek Found Dead in Sitka Hotel." The accompanying text whips up a tissue of miracles, evasions, and outright lies about the life and death of Menachem Mendel Spielman late Thursday night at the Hotel Zamenhof on Max Nordau Street. According to the medical examiner's office, the examining doctor himself having moved to Canada, the preliminary finding on cause of death is something known in fairy tales as drug-related misadventure. Though little known to the world outside, the Togs man writes, "In the closed whirl of the pious, Mr. Spielman was viewed for the better part of his early life as a prodigy, a wonder, and a holy teacher, indeed as possibly the long-promised redeemer. The old Spielman home on South Anski Street in the Harkovy was often thronged with visitors and supplicants during Mr. Spielman's childhood, with the devout and the curious traveling from as far as Buenos Aires and Beirut to meet the talented boy who was born on the fateful ninth day of the month of Av. Many hoped and even arranged to be present on one of a number of occasions when rumors flew that he was about to declare his kingdom. But Mr. Spielman never made any declarations. 23 years ago, on the day projected for his marriage to a daughter of the Strakenzer Rebbe, he all but disappeared, and during the long ignominy of Mr. Spielman's recent life, the early promise had largely been forgotten." The chaff from the ME's office is the only item in the story resembling an explanation of the death. Hotel management and the central division are said to have declined comment. At the end of the article, Lantzman learns that there will be no synagogue service, just the burial itself, at the old Montefiore Cemetery, to be presided over by the father of the deceased. "Berko said he disowned him," Esther Malka says, reading over Lantzman's shoulder. "He said the old man wanted nothing to do with the kid. I guess he changed his mind." Reading the article, Lantzman suffers a cramp of envy toward Mendel Spielman, tempered by pity. Lantzman struggled for many years under the weight of fatherly expectations, but he has no idea how it feels to fulfill or exceed them. Isidore Lantzman, he knows, would have loved to father a son as gifted as Mendel. Lantzman can't help thinking that if he had been able to play chess like Mendel Spielman, maybe his father would have felt he had something to live for, a small messiah to redeem him. Lansman thinks of the letter that he sent his father, hoping to gain his freedom from the burden of that life and those expectations. He considers the years he spent believing that he caused Isidore Lansman a fatal grief. How much guilt did Mendel Spielman feel? Had he believed what was said of him, in his gift or wild calling? In the attempt to free himself from that burden, did Mendel feel that he must turn his back not only on his father, but on all the Jews in the world? I don't think Rabbi Spielman ever changes his mind, Lansman says. I think somebody would have to change it for him. Who would that be? If I had to guess, I'm thinking that maybe it was the mother. Good for her. Trust the mother not to let them toss her son out like an empty bottle. Trust the mother, Lansman says. He studies the photograph in the Tag of Mendel Spielman at 15, beard patchy, side locks flying, coolly presiding over a conference of young Talmudists who seethed and sulked around him. "The Tzadik Hador in Better Days," reads the caption. "What are you thinking about, Meyer?" Esther Malka says, striking a note of doubt. "The future," Lansman says. 23. A mob of black-hat Jews chugs its way, a freight train of grief, from the gates of the cemetery, the House of Life, they call it, up a hillside toward a hole cut into the mud. A pine box, slick with rain, pitches and tosses on the surf of weeping men. Satmars hold umbrellas over the heads of Verbivers. Gearers and Strakensers and Visnitzers link arms with the boldness of schoolgirls on a lark. Rivalries, grudges, sectarian disputes, mutual excommunications. They've been laid aside for a day so that everyone can mourn with due passion a Yid who was forgotten by them until last Friday night. Not even a Yid. The shell of a Yid, thinned to transparency around the hard void of a 20-year junk habit. Every generation loses the Messiah it has failed to deserve. Now the pious of the Sitka district have pinpointed the site of their collective unworthiness and gathered in the rain to lay it in the ground. Around the gravesite, black clumps of fir trees sway like grieving chassids. Beyond the cemetery walls, hats and black umbrellas shelter thousands of the unworthiest of the unworthy against the rain. Deep structures of obligation and credit have determined which are permitted to enter the gates of the House of Life, and which must stand outside kibitzing, with rain soaking into their hose. These deep structures, in turn, have drawn the attention of detectives from burglary, contraband, and fraud. Lansman picks out Skulski, Berwitz, Feld, and Globus, always with a shirt tail hanging out, perched on the roof of a gray Ford Victoria. It's not every day that the entire Verbiver hierarchy comes out and stands around on a hillside, posed in relation to one another like circles on a prosecutor's flowchart. On the roof of a Walmart a quarter mile away, three Americans in blue windbreakers point their telephoto lenses and the trembling pistol of a condenser microphone. A stout blue cord of latkes and motorcycle units has been stitched through the crowd to keep it from coming undone. The press is here, too, cameramen and reporters from Channel 1, from the local papers, crews from the NBC affiliate over in Juneau and a cable news channel. Dennis Brennan, without the sense or maybe enough felt in the world to cover that big head of his against the rain. Then you have the half-believing and the half-observant and the modern orthodox and the merely credulous and the skeptical and the curious and a healthy delegation from the Einstein Chess Club. Lansman can see them all from the vantage of his powerlessness and his exile, reunited with his supersport on a barren hilltop across Mismer Boulevard from the House of Life. He parked in a cul-de-sac some developer laid out, paved, then saddled with the name of Tikva Street, the Hebrew word denoting hope and connoting to the Yiddish ear on this grim afternoon at the end of time 17 flavors of irony. The hoped-for houses were never built. Wooden stakes tied with orange flags and nylon cord map out a miniature Zion in the mud around the cul-de-sac, a ghostly era of a failure. Lansman is flying solo, sober as a carp in a bathtub, clutching a pair of binoculars in his clammy grip. The need for a drink is like a missing tooth. He can't keep his mind off it, and yet there's something pleasurable in probing the gap. Or maybe the ache of something missing is just the hole left behind when Bina lifted his badge. Lansman waits out the funeral in his car, studying it through the good Zeiss lenses and running down the car battery with a CBC radio documentary about the blues singer Robert Johnson, whose singing voice sounds as broken and reedy as a Jew saying Kaddish in the rain. Lansman has a carton of Broadways, and he burns them wildly, trying to drive from the Supersport's interior a lingering odor of Willie Zilberblatt. It's a foul smell, like a pot of water in which 2 days ago somebody boiled noodles. Berko tried to persuade Lantzman that he was imagining this residue of the little Zilberblatt's brief tenure inside Lantzman's life, but Lantzman is happy for the excuse to fumigate with cigarettes, which don't kill the urge for a drink but somehow dull its bite. Berko also tried to persuade Lantzman to wait a day or two on the matter of Mendel Spielman's death by misadventure. As they rode down in the elevator from the apartment, he dared Lantzman to look him straight in the eye and tell him that Lantzman's plan for this damp Monday afternoon did not consist of showing up, shorn of his badge and his gun, to hurl impertinent questions at the grieving queen of gangsters as she departed from the house of life and the remains of her only son.
"You can't get near her," Berko insisted as he followed Lantzman out of the elevator and across the lobby to the door of the Dnieper.
Berko was in his elephantine pajamas. Pieces of his suit were spilling out of his arms. He had his shoes hooked over two fingers, his belt around his neck. From the breast pocket of his mustard pajamas, with their white pinstripe, the points of two slices of toast protruded like a pocket square.
"And even if you can, you still can't."
He was making a nice policeman-like distinction between the things that balls could accomplish and those that the breakers of balls would never permit.
"They will stiff-arm you," Berko said. "They will shake out your pants for the small change. They will bring you up on charges."
Lantzman could not refute the point. Bathsheba Spielman rarely set foot beyond the boundary of her deep and tiny world, but when she did, it was likely to be in a heavy thicket of iron and lawyers.
"No badge, no backing. No warrant, no investigation, looking half crazy, with egg on your suit. You bother the lady, you could get shot, with only minor after-effects for the shooters."
Berko trailed Lantzman out of the building, dancing into his socks and shoes, down to the bus stop at the corner. "You're saying don't do it, Berko," Lantzman said. "Or just don't do it without you. You think I'll let you piss away whatever shot you and Estomalka have to get through to the other end of reversion? You're crazy. I've done you a lot of disservices and caused you a lot of trouble over the years, but I hope I'm not that much of an ass. And if you're saying you don't think I should do it, period, well..." Lantzman stopped marching. The full weight of good sense behind this second argument struck him.
"I don't know what I'm saying, Meyer. I'm just saying, fuck."
Berko got this look sometimes, more when he was a boy, a shine of sincerity on the whites of his eyes. Lantzman had to look away. He turned his face to the wind blowing in off the sound.
"I'm saying at least don't take the bus, all right? Let me drive you down to the impound yard, at least."
There was a distant rumble, a screech of air brakes. The 61B Harkavy appeared farther down the promenade, kicking up a shimmering curtain of rain.
"At least this," Berko said.
He hoisted his suit jacket by the collar. He held it out as if he wanted Lantzman to put it on.
"In the pocket. Take it."
Lantzman weighs the Sholem in his hand now, a cute little Beretta 22 with a plastic grip, poisons himself on nicotine, tries to understand the lamentations of this Black Delta Yid, Mr. Johnson. After a period that he doesn't bother to note or measure, call it an hour, the long dark train, discharged of its goods, starts back down the hill toward the gates. At the head of it, puffing slowly, head erect, broad-brimmed hat running rein, comes the locomotive bulk of the 10th Verbiver Rebbe. Behind him come the string of daughters, 7 or 12 of them, and their husbands and children, and then Lantzman sits up and dials in a crisp Zeiss image of Bathsheba Spielman. He's been expecting some kind of witchy amalgam of Mrs. Macbeth and American First Lady, Marilyn Monroe Kennedy in her pink pillbox hat, with mesmeric spirals for eyes. But as Bathsheba Spielman comes into clear view, right before she falls below the line of mourners jamming the cemetery gates, Lantzman remarks a small bony frame, an old lady halt in her tread. Her face is concealed behind a black veil. Her clothes are unremarkable, a vehicle for blackness. As the Spielmans approach the gates, the line of uniformed Nazis gathers into a tight knot, driving the crowd back. Lantzman slips the gun into his hip pocket, switches off the radio, and gets out of the car. The rain has slowed to a steady fine mesh. He begins to lope down the hill toward Mizmer Boulevard,